Boston.
From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. What makes Tony Blair tick? That's the question on both sides of the pond. America's best friend was cozy with Clinton and now stands firm with George W. on Iraq. So far, the Blair government has sent 40,000 troops to the Persian Gulf. Both the U.S. and Britain waved the red, white, and blue. But what are the limits of this friendship? Blair's popularity is plummeting. One poll puts his domestic approval at 35%, the worst in 2 years. Editorial cartoonists depict him as America's poodle, and members of his own Labor Party are criticizing him. Still, with his political life teetering on the edge, Tony Blair stands firm. Last Saturday, on the same day about a million Britons protested against the war, Tony Blair addressed his own Labor Party, and he did not back down.
I do not seek unpopularity as a badge of honor. But sometimes it is the price of leadership, and it is the cost of conviction. And as you watch your TV pictures of the march, just ponder this. If there are 500,000 on that march, that is still less than the number of people whose death Saddam has been responsible for. If there are 1 million, that is still less than the number of people that died in the wars that he started.
What do you make of the man at number 10 Downing Street? Is America's best friend in serious trouble? Has his stance influenced what you think about Iraq? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Pippa Norris, lecturer in comparative politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of Britain Votes 2001. Hi, Pippa.
Pleasure to be here.
So glad you could join us. And also with us on the line, burning the midnight oil in London, is Michael White, political editor for The Guardian. From 1984 to 1988, he served as the paper's Washington correspondent. Welcome, Michael.
Good evening.
I hope you have a nice cup of strong tea at your elbow, since it's pretty late where you are. Thanks
so
much.
I'll do my best.
Well, thank you so much for being able to join us. Let me put the first question to you, and let's look ahead for a moment at next week. The United States and Great Britain, as you know, are ready to make their case again to the United Nations, and I'm wondering how badly does Prime Minister Blair need this second resolution?
Yes, he needs it a great deal. Public opinion, as you say, in Britain has been increasingly firming up against premature military action against Saddam Hussein's Iraq. It's not that people think he's not a menace to his neighbors and potentially to us. They just don't think the case has been made for a preemptive attack upon Iraq with all the dangers and uncertainties that bring. But on the other hand, if there is a second United Nations resolution and the troops go in under UN sanction, that will swing quite a lot of people back into the Prime Minister's camp, not least of all members of his own party, so it's pretty important to him.
How did those numbers break down? There's a significant difference between the numbers of people in the UK who are willing to go in with a second resolution versus the people who are in favor without one, right?
Well, the polls vary, but at the moment, instead of being evenly balanced as it was about 3 or 4 months ago when the first UN resolution, 2 or 3 months ago when the first UN resolution was passed, I think it's down to about 29-30% would be willing to go if necessary. 52% are currently against. These figures vary from poll to poll, but there's no doubt about it that most people acknowledge the danger of Saddam Hussein to his own people and to others, but are skeptical about the justification for war now, particularly since it's a preemptive attack. Most of the recent interventions by NATO, the UN, or the United States and its immediate allies have been responsive. This is to launch an attack, and people are genuinely troubled about that in Britain and indeed throughout Western Europe. It's pretty consistent.
I think his stance in the United States, he has usually been viewed favorably by most Americans, I think it's fair to say, as a world-class politician, as a great communicator, as a bridge builder. He said he did not seek unpopularity, but it certainly sounds as if he's found it.
Well, Blair is acting very much on conviction. Unusual for Western European politicians who, unlike Americans, tend not to wear their religion on their sleeve, Tony Blair is probably the most active Christian in number 10 Downing Street? Well, I'm hesitating, certainly since Neville Chamberlain or Stanley Baldwin, and quite possibly since William Gladstone in the late 19th century. And that's an interesting point of comparison, because Gladstone was a liberal interventionist. He believed in, Woodrow Wilson once said, another liberal interventionist, you know, teaching those pesky Latin Americans to elect good men. And so they believe in the rightness of their cause and the willingness to back it with arms. Bob Dole, on another occasion, spoke about Democrat wars, and there's a touch of that in this mix, although, of course, George Bush is not a Democrat.
Well, with his party, at least some elements of his party, and a great deal of public opinion against him at the moment, it does make you wonder why he persists. I mean, it makes you wonder, does he know something that the rest of us do not?
Well, British political leaders, as indeed in other countries, pay visits to newspaper offices from time to time in the course of their busy routine. And on the morning of Monday, I think it was September the 10th, and 2001, I repeat, the 10th, not the 11th, Tony Blair happened to be at my newspaper, The Guardian, and was giving us the usual mixture of seduction, complaint, and extempore assessment of the world situation. And some of us were struck by the extent to which, on that day, he was talking a good deal about weapons of mass destruction and the dangers which they posed from rogue states, as I don't think they were then called, and about terrorism. And we were all struck by, what's this man going on about weapons of mass destruction for? And of course, the following day, it all looked rather different. So this isn't a sort of late preoccupation of Blair's. Somewhere in the system, he has seen that in the post-Cold War order, the threat to stability, which was a funny kind of stability in the Cold War, but we all took it for granted. We all knew the rules, that the threat of states outside the sort of broad framework of international affairs might wreak an enormous amount of havoc with weapons which civilized states, if I can use that word, usually don't use. So he's been on the case for some time. And also, a second point about British politicians, probably be familiar to many of your listeners, since George Bush seems to have adapted Winston Churchill too. I suppose Mr. Bush can hardly adapt FDR, since he was a Democrat. But Churchill is the sort of template of national resolution when you're looking for a role model. If you're a British political leader, Margaret Thatcher did much the same. You tend to look back to resolution in the face of great odds. And Blair's doing a bit of that, consciously, I suspect, as well as subconsciously.
Pippa Norris, I wonder if you'd expand on that point a little bit and give us a little character sketch of Tony Blair. You've been observing him for a long time. What about his previous life, both politically and personally, makes his current stand more understandable?
Well, one of the most interesting things about the current dilemma is that it's really reversed his image. In the past, he used to be seen very much as being led by the polls, as somebody who would go with the spin, who was always trying to sell the British public. And that was partly because, if you think about the man, he was somebody who came into the Labour Party from a fairly middle-class background. He went to Fettes College, he went to Oxford. At the time, he looked a bit like a hippie, but he came from that sort of background. He entered the Labour Party at a time of tremendous change. It was under revision, and it had been changing, in fact, for many years, and moving away from the left, abandoning its old principles, modernising and not really knowing exactly where it was going in future, moving towards the centre ground. As a result, when he came into power in 1997 with an enormous majority, which nobody expected, he didn't even expect it on that night, and then in 2001, he became essentially dominant in British politics, and he was a leader who was always seen as essentially somebody who had his finger on the pulse of the British public. What's happened with these current events very much is that he's come out much more clearly as having a very distinct stance. And in a sense, as Michael said, this isn't unexpected. On many foreign policy issues, British prime ministers often do strike a fairly independent line. And he's done it in the past. Remember, he's already sanctioned 5 military interventions. He has already taken a fairly strong stance on Europe and on the euro, which he wants to belong when the time is right. And he's been very active on the world stage. He's, for example, had a policy which has been trying to emphasise how the United States and the world and the United Nations need to move much more actively on things like poverty and AIDS and a variety of other international issues. So what we've seen with this event is a catalyst which has reversed his image. And the old popularizer is in some ways seen as much more a man of principle and conviction.
So indeed, when he makes a moral argument, that's very much of a piece of who he is.
Very much of his image now. Of course, it is undermined when others come along and criticize that, particularly as we've seen just recently the church and the clergy saying if there's a moral argument, okay, they'll say it's not based on risk, it's not based on the threat to British foreign policy interests, and it's not based on a link particularly with Al-Qaeda. If it's based on a moral argument, then that has to be articulated very clearly. And so far, he's certainly tried to articulate that case, and he is somebody who can certainly put that case forward. But so long as many others have their doubts, as they do, about the rightness of the cause and the rightness of a preemptive strike, I think that needs to be emphasized, then he's got a tough case to sell.
Is there any sort of comparison that can be drawn here to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who had very much her own agenda? She didn't much care, or didn't appear to care very much, whether people approved of it or not. She was going to stick to her guns.
Well, again, she had an enormous majority in the House of Commons. She felt that she had her finger on the pulse of the British people because they were supporting her, apparently, in successive elections. So to that extent, they're both in the same position. And the other thing is, when we think about what Mrs. Thatcher did with her special relationship with Reagan, on a number of occasions, she did intervene very actively. And again, she changed some of the issues in American foreign policy, and she acted as that bridge between the US and the rest of the world. So any prime minister, it's not just a matter of personality and character, but any British prime minister tries to fulfill that role. They feel close to America. The cliche of the special relationship is sometimes overemphasized, but there is something there as well. And at the same time, they feel they are a channel of communication to Europe and to NATO and to the United Nations. So it's partly personality and his position of power, but also basically British foreign policy. If it wasn't Blair, if it was somebody else like Gordon Brown or even the leader of the opposition, you might well find a similar sort of relationship developing.
Michael White in London, remind us of what happened with John Major, who was prime minister during the first Gulf War. Did he run into similar opposition?
Not in quite the same way. Mr. Major, people often forget this. It was an extraordinary few weeks. Mr. Major had inherited the a commitment to send British forces to the Gulf from Margaret Thatcher. In fact, many people assumed at the time that with a conflict looming that they would never dare overthrow Mrs. Thatcher. When the challenge to her leadership, the direct challenge, came in November 1990, I remember it very vividly, she was actually in Paris signing, Pippa Norris will correct me if I'm wrong, the peace treaty which ended the Second World War, which had never actually been signed, and she went there to show it was business as usual. It was a bad mistake, because while she was away, instead of being engaged in the dirty business of politicking and sewing up those votes, she actually lost the leadership election. Major came in, inherited the policy. She had been, to some extent, instrumental in putting a bit of backbone in George Bush. Don't go wobbly on us now, George. She is alleged to have said at some fancy conference in Aspen when Saddam Hussein sent troops into Kuwait the previous August. And Major conducted the policy set out on her lines. He conducted in a less triumphalist manner. And at the time, many people were grateful for that. They'd got a little tired of Lady Thatcher's histrionics and bombast. And when he, after one ministerial broadcast during the war, he said, "Good night, God bless you." The entire nation chuckled and said, "Well, Ma Thatcher would never have said that." On the other hand, as the 90s developed, Mr. Major's political and personal weaknesses developed, and Tony Blair was the beneficiary. I'm not entirely sure that his position is on all fours with hers, because she was a conservative politician. Ronald Reagan was a fellow conservative. They'd both promoted free markets. They'd both been responsible for the sort of anti-statist counter-revolution of the 80s. And Mrs. Thatcher, of course, was increasingly hostile to Europe. Mr. Blair, in domestic politics, is much closer to Bill Clinton. In fact, the back end of that speech in Glasgow, which you took an extract from a moment ago, which I was present for, was a defense of the British national health care system, which is an even more socialized healthcare system than the Canadians. I know the people next door to you in Maine and Vermont appreciate the benefits of the Canadian system, but Americans are terrified of it, and it was an implicit explicit criticism of the American healthcare
system. Michael, we have to stop you there. We need to take a break. We're talking about what makes Tony Blair tick. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Tony Blair's predicament. He stands firm with the United States against Saddam, even as opposition mounts at home. Is America's best friend in big trouble? Do you admire the strength of his convictions, or think he is leading his country and the world down the wrong path? Has his stance influenced your feelings about the war? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Pippa Norris, lecturer in comparative politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and from London, Michael White, political editor for The Guardian. From 1984 to 88, he served as the paper's Washington correspondent. And joining us now on the line from Washington is Justin Webb, who is the Washington correspondent for the BBC. Hello, Justin.
Good evening.
Let me ask you this. Is it fair to say that a lot of the British public's issue with Tony Blair at the moment is two words, George Bush?
Yes, I think it probably is fair to say that, actually. And people could never understand quite why these two got along, and they didn't really want them to get along. There is this sort of sense of intellectual superiority. Harold Macmillan, the former British Prime Minister, former by quite a long way, back in the 50s and early 60s, he was the guy who said that English people should play the Greeks to the Americans' Romans. In other words, we should be the thoughtful, clever ones without the army, and we should keep the chaps with the army, but not much in the upstairs region, in check. And I think that was what the British people thought that Mr. Blair would do. And then suddenly he was in bed with Mr. Bush, and they were talking about using the same toothpaste, and it was all really peculiar. This toe-curling news conference, the first one that they held, this is long before September the 11th and all these other events where they had a sort of getting-to-know-you news conference. It was at Camp David, I think, and the only thing they could think of that they had in common was that they both used Colgate toothpaste. And Blair said, "Goodness, George, people are going to wonder how you know that." And it was all absolutely appalling. And people thought, "Well, goodness, you're going to have to play this old British role of being morally and intellectually superior." But he hasn't played it. He's sort of said that Bush is a good guy. And I think a lot of British people find that mystifying and think in a way that Blair is missing a trick, because if we can't play that role, what other role can we play? We are reduced to being poodles, and that's what they regard him as doing.
And do you see a difference in terms of his relationship with Bill Clinton and with Bush, in terms of Clinton had been in office for a number of years when Tony Blair became prime minister, and so in a sense some have said he played sort of the younger brother, and now he's able to be the older brother, the person who has been there and had the experience. So with Bush, he's enjoying that role.
Yes, and British prime ministers can't be too choosy about the politics of the guy across the Atlantic. They've always had to fit in as best they can and gloss over political differences. I think also Blair is more like Bush, in a sense, than he is like Clinton. I mean, when you think of the moral questions over the Clinton White House, let's put it like that, particularly regarding sexual probity, and then you think of Blair and his overtly presented Christianity, I could see a lot of parallels that are closer between Blair and Bush than were the case between Blair and Clinton.
Michael White in London, is there any evidence that Tony Blair wants something from Washington in exchange for his steadfast standing by George Bush at this moment, and do you think he's likely to get it?
Well, you hope for influence, and you hope for vulgar things like probably access for British Petroleum, a major oil corporation, to whatever's going in Iraq, in the reorganization, modernization of the Iraqi fields, things like that. I agree with most of what Justin said, except to make a general point. I'm not sure that the British feel condescending towards the Americans anymore. That was true in Harold Macmillan's time. And secondly, having seen Ronald Reagan at close quarters, in the 80s, one could see why Americans liked him. There was a kind of, he made people feel all right. It was sort of very relaxed and easygoing. But that style of sort of southwestern populism, I know I'm talking to an audience in Boston here, doesn't export very well. And Europeans, conservative or liberal leftish, tend to be a bit frightened by the kind of cowboy image which American populists from the south and west, let's say from the Mississippi to Santa Barbara, cultivate. It just doesn't travel. So there's an additional problem with the president, and perhaps more worrying than the president, with Mr. Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Wolfowitz, who all of them people who managed to avoid service in the Vietnam War. Europeans noticed these things, who are beating the drum now. That really does make us nervous.
Michael White, I know you want to get to bed. We thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Pippa Norris, let me ask you that question as well, in terms of what Tony Blair might reasonably expect to have from Washington.
Well, it's partly any sort of personal benefits that he's going to acquire in terms of straddling the world stage. When you're seen as close to Bush, then you're seen as close to the heart of the public policy process. But I think it's more than that. I think he really does also want, very genuinely, not to let the US become isolationist, not to let, essentially, Bush go to war on his own or in a coalition of the willing, which only has Australia, Spain, and perhaps Bulgaria, which doesn't seem very credible. So he wants to tie and to link Bush's policy strongly to the United Nations. He's very committed to international organizations. He's very committed to NATO. And he thinks that any world power which goes alone is really very dangerous for all sorts of foreign policy implications. So it's not just personal, I think.
And yet, at the end of January, we're told that the Prime Minister came away pretty much empty-handed from his last visit to the White House. He wanted to get some sort of sense of movement on a Middle East peace negotiation, and no dice, evidently.
That's right. Well, he particularly says that there has to be a solution in Palestine, there has to be new talks, and that Europe should take some initiative. He also sees that, of course, America is absolutely critical to any sort of initiative that's going to be successful with Israel. And it appears that that has been put on the back burner and he hasn't succeeded. On the other hand, if one saw a positive outcome from Iraq and a positive outcome from intervention, then presumably the whole of the politics of the Middle East could change in some dramatic ways, and Bush could then start to turn his attention away from the single obsession of Iraq towards other forms of problems in the area.
So sometimes better to wait. I want to bring in some of our callers. Now, Jim is phoning in from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim. Hello, Jim. All right. We seem to have lost Jim. Let's hear from Paul now. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to say that I'm probably in the minority, but I think that Tony Blair has done an exceptional job, and I have been someone who didn't think much of him before, but I am amazed at a politician who actually stands up in this day and age and goes against the public opinion and the media and all the people who are telling him he's wrong. I think he deserves applause, and I hope in 2 months when the war is over, he'll be treated as the hero that he has been.
Thanks for the comment, Jim. Sorry, Paul. Justin Webb in Washington, let me ask you whether you get a sense of Americans as being a little less cynical, perhaps, about Tony Blair than they might be of their own president.
Yes, absolutely, because you've got all the advantages of Mr. Blair. You've got the nice smile, and he comes across occasionally and says things that Americans generally want to hear, nice things about America and about the policy of the president. But you don't get the downside, which people in Britain find him rather preachy and rather hypocritical, and all the other things that have led to him becoming progressively really less and less popular. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose that's always the case abroad. You always have slightly rose-coloured spectacles when you look at someone who's reasonably disposed towards your own country. Just on the point of his power at the moment, I mean, I don't know how much there is, obviously, there are all sorts of things that he personally can get out of this and that Britain can get out of this, and Michael mentioned a few of them. I think at the moment, one of the things he has bought, though, unquestionably, is just leverage over what happens now. I mean, in a sense, he has a veto over whether or not there is a war, certainly in the next few months. And I think that's something that, for a British Prime Minister in the early part of the 21st century, is quite an achievement in a way. It's certainly Jacques Chirac doesn't have a veto, and Mr. Schroeder doesn't. And Blair has worked himself into a position where he is pretty powerful. I guess at the end of the day, if he said no, then the president would eventually go to war, but goodness, he'd be awfully isolated and it'd be desperately worrying in terms of American public opinion if he had to say, look, I've had to do this without my closest ally. So Mr. Blair has got himself into a politically, and in terms of international kudos, and these things do count for things, he's got himself into an awfully powerful position.
We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have now found Jim on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim.
Yes, thank you. Good evening to you all. I've got to commend the British people and the religious community who have spoken with stentorian voices on their opposition to this war. The more important point I want to make is that while I believe in Prime Minister Blair's convictions, I have to doubt his motivations. And this goes back to his infamous dossier, which he committed the crime of unacknowledged borrowing of material, what we call plagiarism in this country. And this was from 91, 92, and from a thesis, and from Jane's Intelligence Review in 97. So if something changed in 2001 or post-2001, why wasn't it in this dossier? And for a prime minister, a person of that level of in the government to make that kind of, commit a crime of sorts, it's unconscionable, especially when we're talking about war.
Thank you so much for the comment, Jim. What about that, Pippa? I mean, it certainly sounds like appalling staff work, to say the least.
Absolutely. And in such a case of plagiarism at Harvard, for example, will get you thrown out. So that would be unacceptable. But let me come back a little bit also to the question of how much of a risk Tony Blair is taking when he goes against the public, which is the point made by Paul earlier. You've got to remember that there are a number of things which mean he's in a very, very strong position. Number one, the Conservative opposition is totally divided. They're squabbling. I mean, today's headlines were not about the war. They weren't about Blair. They weren't about all the problems that he's facing. They were all about replacement of personnel in Smith Square and all sorts of other issues that are very arcane and not of interest to your listeners, but are really symbolising the suicide wish in the official Conservative Party. Number two, he still has an enormous majority. And that shouldn't be underestimated, even if he has some dissenters. There's going to be a debate on Wednesday in Parliament, which is really going to open this all up. And I'm sure there are going to be some who are on the left in the Labour Party who disagree with Blair, as there might be some in some other parties, and particularly in the Lib Dems. But he's going to get his vote through, in all probability, simply because he's got so many votes he can waste. And number three, even though his own personal support is down, we have to remember it's been down far worse in some other administrations, such as Major. And also the Labour voting support is down, but it's not down that much. It's a criticism much more of Blair, the Prime Minister, than it is of the Labour Party. They are in their midterm, normally a time when people are very critical. They're also have got all sorts of problems of public services, of unemployment, of education and of transport, etc. But still, they've got an 8-point lead over the Conservatives.
And I think there's another important, if I can just butt in there, because yeah. I think that's such an important point, and I would add another one, which is that people in America often assume that we have thousands of elections in Britain, as you do here, and someone gets in and is almost immediately thrown into campaigning to get in again. It ain't the case. Tony Blair won an election in, when was it, the summer of 2001. I mean, he doesn't need to hold another until 2006. An awful lot can happen, and an awful lot of good things in the sense of a short, successful war. And you know, people could well have forgotten about Iraq by the time the British public next have to choose their leader, and that must also put him in a very strong position.
And also the fact, I would imagine, that the Conservative Party is also for the war, or at least not against the war.
Yes, well, they're not really for or against anything, as people are saying at the moment. They spend most of their time sacking their senior staff, but then nobody's heard of their senior staff anyway. So I mean, they're in such a catastrophic position, and it's not like the opposition party in America, where you sort of get yourself together and eventually find a reasonable presidential candidate and rally behind them. That doesn't necessarily happen in Britain. The Conservatives could actually fall apart completely mm-hmm. before the next election, and that plainly would put Blair in an even stronger position.
And the other point there is also that the party which is benefiting, the Lib Dems, are on the left of Labour, just slightly, and they're critical of the war. But, of course, if they go up, the irony is they could well take some support from the Conservatives, not from Labour.
Let's go back to our phone line. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hi. there was a mention made of Tony Blair's hypocrisy, and I try to listen to BBC a lot. I just don't know what they're talking about. We don't get news about that kind of issue over here. So I wonder if I could hear some examples, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Justin, I believe that may have been a comment from you.
Yes, it was. Yeah. I suppose the principal thing that people don't like about Tony Blair is that he tends, for instance, I mean, let me give you the up-to-date criticism that he's getting today. He's just made what he says is the moral case for war. This is in reply to various church leaders in Britain who've said that there isn't a case at the moment. And the head of a very big charity has come out and said, for goodness sake, how can you say these things? We've been calling for years and years for alterations to be made to the sanctions system, not to get rid of it completely, but to alter it so that Iraqi children, those same Iraqi children that you, Mr. Blair, now say you're desperately concerned about rescuing from Saddam Hussein, we've been calling on you to do things to help us, and you haven't done them. And there's this sense with Blair that he's just rather slippery, actually, that he is someone who is intensely politically tuned in, but that he is capable, perfectly capable of doing one thing, saying one thing, having recently done another. And there are certainly other examples of that go back right throughout really the time that he's been in office.
Do you see that as a problem as well, Pippa? Because certainly we've seen Blair's arguments about the war changing just as George Bush's arguments have changed in terms of, well, this is about weapons of mass destruction. No, it's about regime change and so on.
Yes, he's tried to respond to all the events which have been unfolding, and he's replaced it as a result by different arguments every day. So when Blix comes along and says, well, in fact, we still want to continue, he's then started to change the argument again. When there was the criticism about the Downing Street report, about the potential links between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, then he started to change that argument as well. So when you keep on changing, you do lose credibility. Obviously, you lose authority. And people say you're off message. In other words, you really haven't got a single thing which you're trying to push forward, which you're trying to argue in this very complex set of issues. So he is trying to respond, but not very successfully, I think.
On the other hand, if you have a leader who just says the same thing over and over as conditions change around him, isn't that risky too?
Yes, but in some ways that's Bush's argument. After all, you know, you're with us, you're against us. The threat is there to America, and it's a threat which isn't just Al-Qaeda, it's not just individuals, but it's the country of Iraq, and there's some sort of link between the two, although unproven. And when you keep repeating the message day after day after day, then it really does get through, and that's what we can see in terms of the public support for these sorts of issues for Bush.
And also we have to keep in mind that polls go up, polls go down. Is there as much fluctuation in British public opinion as we see here sometimes?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I think there is the distinction. It's the distinction that Justin made earlier, which is that politicians in Britain don't live and die by the polls. They're in there for a longer period. And it's a parliamentary system, not a presidential system. And that is really important. Where the president is high in the polls here, he can get his actions through DC because Congress is going to listen to him. He has all of that credibility. If he can say 60% of the public is for me. In Britain, it's not so critical. If you get your majority in Parliament together, that's what you need.
We're talking tonight about what makes Tony Blair tick. The British Prime Minister is standing firm with the Bush administration on Iraq, even as his popularity plummets at home. Is America's best friend in big trouble? Do you admire him for standing up for his convictions? And what does the historic relationship between the United States and Britain mean to you? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about British Prime Minister Tony Blair's predicament. He's standing firm against Saddam and is warning critics of his Iraqi policy that those seeking to divide the EU from the U.S. are playing a dangerous game. Is America's best friend in trouble? Do you admire his conviction? Or is he leading his country and the world down a dangerous road? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pippa Norris is here with me in the studio. She is a lecturer in comparative politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of Britain Votes 2001. And on the line from Washington, Justin Webb, Washington correspondent for the BBC. And we have a lot of callers with a lot of things to say, so let's go to our lines and speak first to Abby. Hi, Abby.
Hello, I'm calling from Martindale. I say hello to your guest. I'd like to make a comment, and I like it's the reaction. I think what Tony Blair is doing, it's true that it's risking with the public, but it's not risking his job with the ruling class. If you consider Britain still imperialistic power, and it hasn't lost its incentives yet, and that shows in Europe that how they are different with other European countries, because they kept their imperialistic and predatory nature, and this support in Iraq war matches with their old nature, and they're still continuing, and they're going to do it in the future, and the reason they're not joining the European Union has something to do with that, too. Thank you.
Thanks, Abby. Justin Webb, you want to respond?
Yes, I think there's something of a truth in that. There's a very colourful British politician called Alan Clark, who died a year or two ago, who used to talk of the British martial spirit. He did it in conjunction with football supporters who often caused trouble. British football supporters, or English football supporters more precisely, go across to Europe and do terrible things and get arrested. And he said, it was a very odd thing for a politician to say, he said, actually, it's a rather good thing, because actually it's part of this British tradition. We go away, as that caller was saying. We have a sort of imperialist and a predatory view. And there is sort of an element of that. I mean, I don't think it's quite as naked as that now, but there is an element of it in British foreign policy. We certainly still believe that we have a right to be involved in world affairs and to punch above our weight in those affairs. And if you look at the size of the country and its economic strength, and even to in a sense the strength of its military now, that possibly we shouldn't be punching that weight. But there is still very much an element in Britain that people do think that Britain should be involved and should have a say at the top table.
Let's go to the lines again and talk to Peter. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you guys?
Very well, thanks.
Great, thanks very much. Great show. My observation is simple. I've looked at the UK scene for a number of years, and generally speaking, public opinion is set by the mindset of people who grew up 20 years ago. You know, when Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote his memoirs about his service in the White House under Carter, as I recall, Britain does not even appear in the index. In the last 10 to 15 years, it's impossible to write a diplomatic history of the West or of the world without a very substantial role played by the United Kingdom. And I guess my observation is that public opinion leaders in the United Kingdom, and particularly in the press, have not quite caught up with the fact that decline arrested somewhere around 1983. And the United Kingdom's position economically, militarily, diplomatically, has been almost consistently rising since that time period. And I just like the observation of your guests, and I'll take my listen off the line.
Thanks so much for the comment, Peter. Pippa, that sounds like one for you.
Well, I'm not sure that I quite agree. When I think, for example, about Britain before this whole Iraq business started, and one looks at, for example, where America was trying to make its links, and it really was with Germany, the new power in Europe, and it was with Japan before all the economic crisis hit the Far East, and it was with many other countries around the world, and Britain, frankly, was being neglected to a large extent. The special relationship was seen as something that was in mothballs. It was something that was nostalgic, and it was kind of nice, but it wasn't real, although the Foreign Office always tried to make it real. So I think that the idea that somehow Britain has always been important to the United States, or has always played a world role, it has by virtue of its institutional position, for example, on the Security Council, and that's a legacy of its old empire as well. But in other regards, I think it was slipping quite remarkably in its position, and America was looking elsewhere.
And let's take a call from Nicholas now. Hi, Nicholas.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good
What's
evening,
on your mind?
I'm wondering, I'm fairly concerned about Tony Blair's, I guess, stance in this, in that the majority of the British electorate is against his stance in this particular situation. And I'm just curious as to whether there's a chance at this point for a vote of no confidence in the British Parliament, or is the right so discombobulated right now that they can't do that? And also, I mean, commenting on another thing that I heard this evening by one of the other listeners is that, you know, him standing up to public opinion is not, you know, it's condemnable versus being actually, you know, attributable to success. I think it's kind of a double-edged sword right there. And any comment on that?
Justin?
Well, in terms of his the possibility of him being subjected to a vote of no confidence in Parliament, I don't think that's going to happen. partly because, you're right, the right, the Conservative Party, are in such a mess, but partly also because, at the end of the day, we have a very strong party system in Britain. I mean, it's not like the Senate here. At the end of the day, if your back's against the wall, and Mr. Blair would be saying, well, all right, if I lose this, I'm going to call a general election, and lots of you, looking at his own supporters, lots of you Labour people will lose your seats, possibly, and your livelihoods, then actually they all tend to rally round, and even in quite extreme circumstances, I think he could expect to win. He's in slightly more difficulties. I mean, I'm not really, in a sense, the right person to answer this, because I live now in Washington, D.C., but I think it's probably fair to say, from my reading of the British press and talking to people, he does face the possibility somewhere down the line, if the war were to go very badly, of a challenge within his own party. And that's a slightly different thing, where the Labour Party just say, well, we're going to have a new leader. And by accident, it's such an oddness of the British system, he can become Prime Minister as well, although nobody's voted for him to become Prime Minister. And that, I mean, he would almost certainly then have to call his own general election. But I think that there is, I don't know what people would say about this, there is at least a chance that he might be thrown out by his own party if things go badly wrong.
That's right. If there's a disastrous outcome in terms of high casualties on the British side, the American side, or high civilian casualties, given the changes in the media in the Middle East, so that public opinion sees the whole thing as a total failure, then it squarely rests on his shoulder. And in the fall, there's going to be the Labour Party conference. And there's already mutterings amongst MPs that there could be a leadership challenge. To be successful, they have to be very well organised and they have to have other credible contenders. And that is one of his weaknesses, because, of course, there is a credible contender in Gordon Brown, the current Chancellor. There have always been rivals to some extent. Gordon Brown is seen as very, very authoritative and credible and a perfectly good Labour leader. So if things go wrong, one could see a challenge that really got rid of Tony Blair, but he was replaced, so the Labour Party goes on.
And on the other hand, Blair has been here before in Kosovo and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So what if everything goes right? I mean, this could be a complete flip side in a very short period of time.
Absolutely. And then, of course, he'll get the credit as well, because if you take those risks, who dares wins?
All right, let's go to Marshall, who's calling in from Stoughton, Wisconsin. Hi, Marshall.
Hi. It's been a long time since I've lived in Europe. And here in the middle of the U.S., you get the impression that every single person in Europe is now rabidly anti-American over this issue. And I wonder if, what is the actual opinion both in Britain and on the continent about Blair versus, say, Chirac and Schroeder? Because from my point of view, it's hard to be more expedient than Schroeder was to get elected. I'd like the opinion of your guest, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks, Marshall. Perhaps a quick comment from Justin Webb?
Well, I think people feel a bit ambivalent about Europe in Britain. And a lot of people in Britain, as we've been hearing, genuinely concerned about Tony Blair's policy, genuinely disagree, but I don't think they necessarily look across the channel and see political leaders that they terribly believe in or back or trust, frankly. So I don't think it's a matter of British people, the British electorate, looking across the water and saying, please, Gerhard Schroeder, come over and rescue us, or Jacques Chirac, come and rescue us. Our relations with the continent, as you know, are slightly tough and have been ever since the continent opened up. That fissure that became the English Channel X billion years ago has caused us to regard ourselves as different. And I don't think this argument, although it is an argument between the British people and their Prime Minister, and one in which the British people seem to be on a par with leaders in Europe, I don't think it really does push people in that direction.
Well, Blair keeps saying that Chirac and Schroeder are friends. But, Pippa, what do you make of that? I mean, is this a friendship that is greatly threatened at this point, more so than we've seen in recent history?
Well, I agree very much with Justin's comments that although people are critical about Blair, that doesn't mean to say they are supportive of Chirac or Schroeder. Indeed, The Sun recently just had a tremendous amount of kerfuffle when they depicted Chirac as a worm on their front page, and this was producing all sorts of reactions in the French press as well. So there's a traditional anti-French feeling in Britain, just as there is in the United States, and it's not that they're compatible in any way.
Justin?
Yes, I think that's true. And I think when you scratch the surface, there is, I mean, for instance, in France, people are desperately concerned about their language, and they're genuinely, genuinely ordinary people suspicious about America. They think that you're trying to get everyone to eat hamburgers and speak American English. Whereas in Britain, we don't have that problem. We grow up with American television, and we're quite happy doing that, generally speaking, though we sometimes complain about it. And we grow up much more comfortable with American culture. We don't really feel threatened by it. And I think that sort of fundamental difference does mean that our attitudes are always going to be closer to America than they are to Europe.
Well, Justin, we complain about it too, so you're not alone. Thanks to you, Justin Webb, Washington correspondent for the BBC. Appreciate your joining us.
Good to be here.
And Pippa Norris, thanks so much. She is a lecturer in comparative politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of Britain Votes 2001.
Thanks so much, Cal.
You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, reaction to last night's deadly fire in Rhode Island. This is On Point. The death toll from last night's fire at a nightclub in West Warwick, Rhode Island, has now reached 95. A pyrotechnics display used by the heavy metal band Great White ignited the blaze, which quickly engulfed the entire building. The club had recently passed its fire inspection, and all of the exits appear to have been functioning properly. But as the flames spread, nearly all of the patrons rushed to the front door, causing a deadly logjam. For tonight's radio diary, we bring you voices from West Warwick, beginning with the governor of Rhode Island, Don Carcheri.
We're all shocked. We're all really deeply saddened that something like this should happen. It shouldn't have happened. It didn't need to happen. As we dig further and further into this, I think we're going to find that people just made some bad decisions about what to do.
They set off fireworks, the band, and they just put fireworks on the stage, set them off, and boom, the place went up so fast, it was like a gasoline can. It really was. People panicked, and they ran for the doors. And it's a mass of people all trying to hit the door. And, I mean, the building just went up that fast. I went out the door. I was out the door in seconds, but when I got outside, the building was gone fast. Just gone fast.
There were many patients who are in critical condition with severe injuries. Most injuries are burns. Burns to the face, to the body. A lot of people have burns to the hands. We suspect they were trying to crawl out on their hands and knees, and that burns to the face, hands, and smoke inhalation injury. A lot of these patients are on ventilators. Some of them did have injuries consistent with trampling.
Your thoughts go to the people that have missing relatives, and you wonder what they're feeling and the concerns they have, not knowing at this particular point. It's just a very difficult time for everybody concerned, and it's tough to have it happen in your town, especially with the incident in Chicago, and to then have the same thing happen in your town, it's just mind-boggling.
The band was on the stage, and they had some pyrotechnics, and something went wrong, and the whole place just went up on fire, and it was insanity, people trying to get out the front door, and I saw people burning up and trying to get people out. I'm missing some of my friends. I don't know where they are.
I'm covered in some girl's blood, and I carried her away from the fire, put her down, and I went back, and it was far too late by that time. The smoke and the flames were just flying out the front door. Horrifying is what it was. Absolutely horrifying.
I think the most important thing right now is all of us, all of our thoughts, all of our prayers need to go out to the families.
Reaction to last night's deadly fire at the Station nightclub in West Warwick, Rhode Island. I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point.